Hi and welcome to What's Next. I'm Therese, your host, and I was trained to be an architect. I work as an architect, and I started this podcast to talk about what's next in the fields of architecture, design, and technology. Facing topics such as climate change, artificial intelligence, and where humanity's place is in this fast-moving world. I hope you enjoy this week's episode, so have fun listening. Good evening, James. How are you?
I'm very good, thanks, Teresa. Thank you for inviting me.
No, I'm very happy that you said yes, that you're on the show. And the first question would be, who are you? Please introduce yourself and your studio.
Yeah, okay. So I'm James Whittaker. I live in London now with my wife and two children. And I've kind of arrived here on a journey that started off in Liverpool in England. I was born there, went to university up in Edinburgh. I've lived a little while in Hong Kong and finally kind of taken residence in London. And I run my own studio, Whittaker Studio, down here, predominantly doing architecture work, but bits of master planning and sort of object design, basically concentrating on the stuff that I enjoy, the stuff that I feel passionate about, and the stuff that kind of that I love to daydream about, the kind of projects that I like to chase.
That's a nice introduction. And before we get deeper into your work, I have some warm-up questions. And the first one would be, what's your favorite drink? Alcoholic, non-alcoholic?
Well, so alcoholic, I really recently, this kind of like started off from just a couple of weeks ago. I went to see the film Banshees of, is it Banshees of Inisherin? There's a new, I went to see this film at the London Film Festival with my brother, and it's fabulous. And all the way through, Colin Farrell keeps going to the pub to get a pint of Guinness. And it's just, it's kind of rekindled my love with Guinness. Because I apart from just being an enjoyable drink, the kind of whole experience of pouring it into the glass and watching that storm settle is just wonderful. It's magical. So I'm a big fan of Guinness, but it's probably tea. Black tea with milk is probably the love of my life. I drink too much every day. I can't drink coffee, but I drink sort of tea nonstop all day long.
English breakfast tea, Earl Grey? Yes.
Oh, no, tea? Yeah, just straight up breakfast tea, Yorkshire breakfast tea, yeah.
I understand. If you could develop a skill overnight, what would you wish for? It can be anything.
Oh, yeah. I mean, actually, the one skill that I probably joke most about is developing an appetite for coffee. I'd love to feel like a grown up and drink coffee. No, if I was to develop a skill overnight, I'd love to be better at carpentry. I don't get to spend enough time doing kind of woodwork. It's one of these things that I find great satisfaction doing the little things that I can do. I'm so fond of well-crafted objects, and but there's always a giant mismatch between my love of the object and my ability to produce that object. But I don't have. There's not enough hours in the day for me to be able to sort of learn that skill. So if I could get it straight away, I'd love to.
No, that's interesting. Most of the people that I interview say flying, time traveling, but you would to work with wood.
Yeah.
It's also really nice.
Yeah. I mean, time travel would be, yeah, don't get me wrong, time travel would be great.
Okay, so woodworking, crafting and time traveling a little bit aside.
Yeah, why not? Why not?
What's your favorite hobby besides architecture?
Oh, well, I think it's got to be piano playing. I mean, I'm someone who I find it very easy to get wildly passionate and enthusiastic about anything that is put me in front of me. So I love and enjoy doing all sorts of things, but it's I think on a day-to-day level, it's piano playing that I just adore. When I was much younger, when I was at school, I used to play the trombone, and now the idea of kind of playing the trombone again doesn't appeal. The physical lip strength the work I'd have to put in to get back to the level that I used to be at, I think would be hard. I wouldn't do it. Whereas the piano, I was never very good at it. So I sit down now and I can read music very well, but I don't feel like I can play the piano very well. So I can only ever improve. And I find it wonderfully relaxing. At the minute, I'm trying to master Clair de Lune, which is just, I can lose myself for forever.
But that's really rare to find in human beings, that they are so excited about anything and that you put in front of them.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah.
No. For me, it has to be really certain things that I am interested. Otherwise, I'm bored really fast. This is really a thing that I would love to have.
Oh, geez, yeah. Apology. It sounds like my little boys are stampeding past the door here on the way to the bathroom to go brush their teeth.
It might be
a later background noise. But yeah, no, I can get very enthusiastic about anything. I think it's just part of it as well is I find it wonderful the diversity out there in the world. So like when it comes to listening to music, I can get just as excited about listening to, I don't know, like listening to a new rap album that's just come out as I could do listening to a jazz recording or a classical music recording. And I really enjoy that. But in a way, that's kind of what I love so much about architecture is the diversity of it. You really have to be a jack of all trades and a master of none. You have to know about lots of different things to be able to do it well. You have to be excited about the challenges of material selection or working with the environment of how to achieve a certain sculptural form. You have to kind of love and enjoy each of these different challenges, and they're all very disparate. They're all kind of very diverging, but you have to love it and enjoy each of those bits to be able to achieve something great, I think, to be able to kind of arrive at a fabulous end result. You've got to dive in.
That's an ability I bet many, many people are extremely jealous of. And your love for architecture brings me to the next question. What's your philosophy? Can you wrap it up, or you haven't figured your philosophy out yet? Are you still on the way to finding it, or can you not even say that there is a philosophy and you just adapt to every single project new?
Yeah, right. I mean, blimey, I don't know if I do have a deep philosophy, and yet I'm very opinionated about things, which often suggests that I do have a philosophy. But I'd say, I guess one of my driving senses is that we live on a planet with finite resource. Like, we need to kind of cherish everything that we make and produce. Like, I when it comes down to personal things, what pair of shoes I buy or what pair of jeans I wear, I'm very kind of meticulous about what I buy. I kind of want to find things that have been, there's been care and attention paid to the sourcing of the materials, the way they've been put together, and then they have them last. And so I often end up wandering around with like trainers that might have a bit of a hole in or something. And I'd much rather kind of do that than discard them and throw them away. And I feel the same about buildings and architecture. I feel an awful lot of things that get built, maybe 90% or 95% of the things that we build in the world are instantly forgettable. They get made quickly and cheaply, or as cheaply as they can be. But they lack kind of, they lack love. They lack the care and attention to make them great. And I often feel like that it's just a wild waste of resource. You end up with these kind of buildings that are built with a lifespan in mind, even at the point that they're conceived, that it doesn't matter. We could rip it down and throw it into landfill in 30 years' time or 50 years' time. I like to sort of take the time and the care to think, well, if we're going to invest energy and time and resource into building something, that thing has to be great. It has to be super. It needs to be worthy of the client's money and everybody's energy and passion involved in making that thing happen. It has to be worth it. And it has to be worth it in terms of the like I say, the finite resource that we have on this planet. If you're going to use one thing, like one piece of rock to make that kitchen counter, it's got to be a good kitchen counter. That piece of rock has taken millions of years to come to being. Mm. We've got to... And so that's kind of, I think that's my philosophy, is that it shouldn't be about quantity, but quality. And I'd much rather build a handful of blockbuster projects than have thousands of forgettable things that get bulldozed before my ears are done, sort of thing.
Your comparison to clothes made me check what I'm wearing today. The pullover is from my aunt, the pants are from my mother, the scarf is from my mother, so that's what I call sustainable.
Yes,
it's like
definitely
40 years old, but it's still good.
yeah well, exactly. It's I'm like the last person to ever go near H&M and things. Not that I appreciate that there's the same. I'm very rude and snobbish about architecture, but I also appreciate that there's different strokes for different folks. Not, it would be inappropriate for every house in the world to be a spiky object made out of shipping containers. That's not appropriate. Nor do I expect everybody in the world to buy clothes like I do. But then that's the joy of it all. It's like not every rap artist is going to play jazz music. It's that's part of the richness and wonderful nature of the world. But yeah, I think if...
How do you start? You receive a new project. How do you start? Do you have a set of rules you stick to? Or do you sit in front of a blank sheet of paper, or do you go out in nature? You have to think about it. How do you start?
It's a very good question. I feel like maybe I should have rules. I feel like it'd be easier for me if I had rules. I guess really, I feel like in terms of how I start, I probably owe an awful lot to my time at Heatherwick's. I think at least when I was there, we used to do an awful lot of like a very iterative process. So we start off a project and we kind of think, okay, well, what can this be? And everyone would draw 10 options, just like dumb diagrams on a sheet of printer paper. 10 fat pen sketches. These are 10 different diagrammatic approaches that we could take. And you're like, okay, well then that one has promise. Let's do 10 options of that one. And so on and so on. And I think that's kind of how I approach projects. I tend to be a little bit more selective than that these days, in that it feels a little bit wasteful on time to be too iterative. But certainly I do tend to try out a lot of options. And even once I've found a route that I think has promise and that I think great, I'll often then kind of like go away and explore a couple of other options, a couple of other avenues, just to kind of double check for myself that was the first thing actually as good as I thought it was, or am I kidding myself and actually there's something better out there to be found? So yeah, I went around trying different options, and the ideas for all those different options kind of come from all over the place. And sometimes you're quite right, like the best ideas appear when you finally stand up from your desk and walk out the door, and you're walking down the street and all of a sudden the penny drops and you're like, ah, that's where the answer is. There's some sort of crazy statistic like that at university level amongst mathematicians, I get this statistic wrong now, but it's something like 90% of maths problems get solved in the park. This sort of idea that you people spend all their time sat at the desk, churning and thinking and thinking and churning. And then finally they stand up, never going to solve this, go for a walk outside. And all of a sudden that you have the revelation, you suddenly like, oh, that's what we need to do. And there definitely has to be an element of that. In a way, that's kind of what I enjoy about piano playing so much, is it kind of gives me that little like a caffeine hit during the day. I'll go down, sit at the piano for 5 minutes, start playing, and then kind of go back and look at something with fresh eyes. Oh, there we go. That's what we need to be doing.
But this statistic should give, it should let offices maybe rethink their way of hosting their employees. Maybe it's not that positive to sit for nine hours a day on your chair at your desk. At some point you're probably really tired.
Yes. But I think most definitely. And I think the listening, I'm sure I read that the thing about the mathematician solving the equation in the park is something to do with the subconscious elements of the brain kind of kicking into gear. And it's kind of when you've been looking at a problem for too long, you kind of start to get sort of blind to it.
Yes.
And it's when you stand up and walk away, the idea comes. So you still have to, you need to have put in the hard work to begin with. But there's also that thing of, but also having time away from it to let your mind settle. And certainly, like you say about the spending all day sat in an office, I remember sort of my last place that I worked, I used to observe so often there the bosses were quite keen that everybody worked a long day, and you'd kind of notice that towards the end of the day everybody had their phones out behind their sort of hidden behind their monitors of their desk. They'd have their phone out checking Facebook or sending messages and stuff, and they weren't being productive. And if you said to those people, look, put your phones away in your drawer, don't touch your phone, but we're going to let you out 2 hours early, sort of thing. You know, you work 6 hours a day or something. You'd achieve a whole lot more. You'd have a much more productive work team if everyone was like, oh, this is awesome, if I just smash through it and get up and go. And actually, I mean, in that regard, that's one of the wonderful things about being my own boss and having young children. My pursuit of architecture, I don't want my pursuit of architecture to come at the cost of valuable time with my boys. or my wife or family, like when I reach my deathbed in life, like ultimately it'll probably be my time spent with my family that I'll cherish the most. But that also makes me very focused when it's time to do work. I have to sit down and I have to really make the most of that time. I have to make every second count so that when I stand up and go off to play with the boys, play football or play on the computer, whatever it is, then my attention is turned 100% to them. And I don't know. I suspect a lot of practices may find that if they treat their employees like grown-ups and sort of gave them that freedom, you would gain a lot more than you lose.
Yeah, make every second count. And the fact that I do not believe that human beings are made to sit the whole day.
No.
It's in our nature to just sit. I do not believe this.
No. And it's, I forget now. I think it was one of my brothers. He worked in IT, and one of his jobs, the company said that basically he had no hours and no holiday in his contract. And it was like, it was just, we're employing you. We trust you to be a sensible grown up and you'll get your work done. And we'll judge you on the work that you do rather than the hours that you spend sat at your desk. And I appreciate that. That was a very big, one of the biggest companies in the world based out of Silicon Valley. They had huge amounts of money that they could do that with. And it would take a very brave architecture practice working at a very small scale to be able to say, oh, we're going to take this approach. But if you said, right, I'm going to judge my employees on the work that they produce rather than how many hours they've sat at their desks, I think you'd get a very interesting result.
I bet you would, yes. Because they are just people like me who need a deadline in front of them to really, but then it's like crazy. Then I can't stop and I really want to finish, also challenging myself if I can make it or not. Something like this.
Yeah, exactly.
To come back to your projects and how you start, I would like to know, what responsibility do you think you have as an architect in this time, building something for someone? In terms of also climate change.
Yeah. Well, I guess a bit like I was saying before, like, you know, if we're on a planet of finite resource, and I think our responsibility is that if we're going to do anything with that resource, we've got to make it good. It can't just be disposable. As I don't know, so like a good example of this might be, this year I've been thinking a bit about a house for a lady in California she's kind of recently widowed. She's in her early 60s, so hopes to retire in sort of 4 years' time. And she approached me wondering if I could help sign her a house to retire to. But she's only got a very, very small budget. I think our biggest problem is that her budget is realistically, it's just too small. And we're going to have to hunt round and find some grant money to make anything happen. But it set me off down a path of wondering, well, what could be the cheapest house that we can build for her that is still a quality piece of architecture that's going to enhance her life through retirement? It's going to be an enjoyable place for her to live, because history is sadly scattered with instances of cheap or buildings built because cost was the main denominator, and they're just awful buildings. The little concrete billets that they built in Australia, that like little stone ovens. There's all sorts of hideous, cheap buildings done, and it's kind of like, well, what can we do that is cheap but allows Rosa to enjoy the environment that she's in, enjoy the passage of sun during the day, be woken up by the sunrise, and enjoy sitting on her veranda outside our living room watching sunset. How can we kind of make it an enjoyable thing for her like that, but also make a piece of architecture that is sort of very energy conscious, that does as much as possible to keep her comfortable in the climate without having to rely on mechanical cooling or heating. So again, kind of thinking, well, this is a lady with very modest life savings, and she can't be spending oodles of money on her energy bills all the time. So is there something that we can do to sort of try and achieve those three things? And it's been a wonderfully interesting sort of project. And I think we've now arrived at something that if we can, like I say, if we could somehow find a bit of grant money to help us with it, it'd make a fantastic sort of residence for her. And hopefully for other people in the future. Sort of my real hope for that project is that we can do it once as a sort of case study, as a precedent, and then be able to roll it out for other low-income families. Sorry, yeah. Did that answer your question? I appreciate it. I go
no,
wandering
it's
off.
Perfectly answered. Perfectly. And it's a really interesting project because it's a challenge and you need to be smart and clever and you need to think a little bit before you do just a average design,
yes,
whatever. And how do you think we could embrace creativity and the need for pragmatic thinking to solve problems like this? How do you think we can reach this point? Because we are living in challenging times. Everything gets really expensive. Everything gets really rare. There's no space for people to live, even though there would be.
Mm-hmm.
We could use it in the right ways. How can we embrace this? Should we start with the youngest among us, the children in school? Should we teach them? Or where do we start to embrace creativity?
I mean, it's such a good question, because I think one of the biggest problems with is that, you know, it's taken a huge basically Rosa appealed to my vanity. She called me up one day and she was very flattering, and I was like, oh, of course I'll design something for you, Rosa. And I sort of pledged myself that I'd take it on as a sort of a charitable project. But that's me being a bit insane. It's not a good way of running a business. and I think the problem is it takes a huge amount of time and thinking to kind of come up with good solutions for these things. But the places where things would have the greatest impact are also often the places where money is tightest, and so there isn't the money to pay people to do the thinking. So like Rose's house, her budget's so tiny, like it's insane to spend as much time as I have done thinking about it. But to kind of think, well, but if that house could end up getting built 1,000 times, then that would have achieved something great. But financially, it's crazy. It'd be far better to do one like luxurious house for one very wealthy person. In terms of pure finances, that would make much more sense. I think that is where it becomes the biggest obstacle. It's like, how can we get people to think about these things well and implement them? Because it's certainly, like, I see it all the time in the UK, that in terms of housing, when the government says we need to build X amount of houses each year to satisfy demand, it generally kind of goes to just the lowest common denominator. They kind of go on, well, this is a cheap house to build. This is how we've always built cheap houses. We're just going to build lots of these cheap houses. And they don't think, is this actually a good thing to be building in the first place? And so I guess you're right. Like, maybe some of the most important things are education and sort of teaching the children in schools, but also documentaries and things. Like, and I think there's opportunity in those type of things to educate the viewers as to what makes this good in terms of its material choice and its responsibility to the environment. But then I also kind of wonder if education is going to achieve results fast enough for what we need them, or whether it requires something a bit more. Certainly, legislation is going to be a key thing. Like my projects in California, California has a phenomenal building control or sort of building requirements, or don't know what you'd call them, but their rules for how you can build a house are very, very rigorous. Yeah, and in terms of how much energy it can use, and it's wonderful because it forces people and it forces everyone to raise their game and aim for a higher standard. I think that is ultimately what is required. If all the people who can afford them rush out and buy Teslas, that's still not going to solve the climate crisis. We need top-down government intervention saying, you know what, you can't build cheap and cheerful buildings anymore. You've got to raise your game. And I think ultimately that if anything will save us, that will be it.
So on the one side, there is a need for social housing built in a really poor quality. Mm. On the other side, there are extremely luxury apartments for rent.
Yes.
Staying empty because nobody lives in them. And my question would be, how much space do you think we as human beings need? Or do you think this is not possible to put a number on?
It's a good question. The Greater London Authority, the GLA, do put a number on it. I can't remember what it is. They've got a whole table of numbers. One of my friends kind of worked on it a few years ago, but the sort of London minimum living standards. Because I think the UK generally has the smallest houses of any country in Europe.
I just read an article about it. If we go overseas, it's a different topic.
I know. It's curious because it's something that I I run up against time and time again with clients, because again, I've grown up in Europe. I'm kind of used to a European size of house, which is, and I'm like, well, this is ample space. Like, why would you need more? I kind of feel like I'm being greedy having as much as I do.
But could you imagine living in just one room, and this room is everything? It's your bedroom, it's your living room, it's your bathroom.
Yeah,
could you imagine this? And everybody, just if we talk about now having a look into the future, is having one concrete box, and in this box you have everything, because there are so many people on this planet, and we just, if you imagine, we have to do this. If we would, do you see this vision coming true, or how do you imagine the future?
I don't know if it'll ever be quite that bleak. But then even this week, there was the news story about the 24-story pig farm. I never thought I'd see something like that. And that was grim. I don't think it would ever be quite as bleak as that. But I do think that there's value to us living in denser cities. Our carbon footprint is smaller when we're living in a dense city than it is if we're living out in the countryside. And so there is merit to us living in a smaller space. And as to whether I can imagine living it, I mean, I guess my time in Hong Kong, I used to live in there were much smaller apartments about, but I lived in a pretty small apartment there. And even like from years ago when I was at university, I remember some guys in Edinburgh did a fantastic project for someone who had this Edinburgh flat that was essentially one room, and they had this one piece of furniture in the center of it the bed would be tucked inside it, and the kitchen would fold out from inside it. That was kind of a wonderful.
Just have a room and it's just a pure closet, and you pull down this, and if you don't want anything at all, you just put it back.
You just fold it away. Yeah, exactly. And I love the sort of Manhattan loft, the sort of abodes of the I don't know, was that like the 70s at a time or 80? I'm not too sure. But essentially, when, again, where they that was big, generous amounts of space, but essentially still the same idea that you had this one space, and then how could they live inside it and have their bedroom and the kitchen and the living room and their working space and everything sort of within this one place. And it's very sort of kind of interesting and curious end results. And it, so similarly, I think working into the future, again, you know, if we came to the conclusion that we do need to have smaller apartments that are more densely packed, then sadly, I suspect you're going to get some developers out there who go, great, we're going to just do this as cheaply as possible with as little thinking as possible and build some pretty gruesome and horrible spaces for people to live in. But if somebody kind of spends just a small portion of time thinking about it, the constraint of space doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be an awful place to live. You could, there would be a way of creating something wonderful for people. It just requires that little bit of thinking.
One more question to your time in Hong Kong. I saw a documentary about those sleep capsules where you just lay like this inside to save space. I could not do this. I have problems even in the small elevator. I cannot. Did you do it?
No. So I think I always thought that was more of a Tokyo thing. Well, might have been. No, so when I was in Hong Kong, I got to like live in a kind of like a comfortable apartment. Yeah. But it's curious, like that's sort of, it's amazing. I've been to universities sort of as a visiting critic, and you know, sort of, and the students are kind of showing you their work. And a tutor might have said to them, oh, you know, why don't you have capsule living accommodation? And yet the building in the middle of the countryside is saying, you know, well, you're completely void of context there. Like the whole idea, the Japanese sort of pod hotels came about because land values are so high in Tokyo. You can only build on you get a very small footprint of land. So then you're trying to maximize your use of that land. And so you end up with these people kind of like sleeping in little pods, a bit like, I don't know, life on a submarine or something. Whereas if you go out into the middle of the countryside, then space isn't such a challenge in the same way. You can afford to kind of make a bit more, give people a bit more elbow room. So I find that all very curious. But no, I haven't ever stayed in a pod. I think that my last tiny sleeping experience was I quite enjoy sort of mountaineering and running in the mountains, and I used to have this very very tiny tent for doing mountain races. And I took my wife wild camping up in the mountains one time. She thought it was like sleeping in a coffin. She hated it.
I can relate to this feeling. I would completely freak out. No.
She's like, can you not have got a proper tent? It's like, a proper tent weighs like another 200 grams, Em. That's
200 grams. No. To finish this topic, could you draw me a picture of the future you imagine for us in 50 years from now? How do you see it, the world?
God.
Do we still have jobs, or is artificial intelligence everything doing for us, and we get like a pension and we just live the perfect life and they work for us? Or how do you imagine it?
Can you imagine? I mean, so again, I'm dodging your question and going off on a tangent, but I read something recently. Someone was talking there about emails and how when when emails were invented, everybody in the world was like, this is amazing. Think how much time we spend at the minute, you know, with our ink bottle and quill, writing out a letter, putting it in the post box and sending it. Now we can do all of that just on this computer. We can write an email, send it, save so much time. And the result is that we now send 100 more correspondence per day than we used to. Are we, it consumes more time than we used to just writing it by hand. And so I don't think AI is ever going to be a answer to that. Any friends that I have who work in the field of AI say that when the general thinking is that we're never going to arrive at some sort of sentient being. Ultimately, they're writing software for a computer, and that software can be very complex and very intelligent, and it can even be self-learning and do lots of wonderful things for us, but it's not going to be a sentient being. It's not going to be able to do stuff on its own without us. And so I don't know, I think maybe the same goes for all machine advances over the years, that they've maybe allowed us to do more, but they haven't done away with people. So sadly, I guess when I think of the future, I don't really anticipate a sort of a realm where we're all just retired, finish university and retire instantly to play golf. I guess I live in a sort of a Victorian era house on a street full of other Victorian era houses. The makeup of this part of London and most of London hasn't changed an awful lot in 100 years. And so when I kind of think, like, how will the world change in the next 50 years? Sometimes it's hard to imagine because the world hasn't changed that much. It's grown a lot, but it's, in some ways, it hasn't changed much in the last 50 years. And I kind of, part of me kind of hopes that with rising pressures, places like London will learn to be denser and more accommodating of embracing a higher density of living than we have at the minute, but we're kind of very protective of our maintaining the status quo.
But that's a perspective that calms me down, really. Because sometimes I just make up some stories in my head that we will all be locked away in concrete houses, really tiny, and we have those glasses on and just create our avatar and then...
Oh, no.
Like the movie. Have you watched the movie Ready Player One?
Yes, yes.
Like this, exactly like this.
I mean, I think it would never be quite that picturesque if we do end up there. The lovely kind of caravan set on scaffolding. I know what you mean. It's interesting. It's because when you look back through history, we like to think of history as being this ever slowly climbing trajectory where life keeps getting better and better. But in reality, it's not. It's more of a sawtooth, isn't it? And you kind of period and empire slowly grows and then falls off a cliff face and goes back and grows. And so looking to the future, there's kind of like, will we remain in this kind of state of relative global political stability that we're in at the minute? It's hard to say. And I don't know. I kind of wonder if instability in politics, like the poor people in Ukraine have seen this year, that can suddenly swing things most dramatically for us. And that sort of stuff, which just none of us know, like these things could happen in 10 years time for any of us. In terms of the environment, I don't know. I mean, part of me, I think, sticks my head in the sand, sort of thinks, well, we can only do what we can each do. We can be careful about the purchases that we make, the clothes that we buy, the building that we commission, or the how we tread on the earth. We can each do what we can. And sometimes it's a bit heartbreaking, kind of feeling like, well, we do a lot. And then you look out the window and somebody drives past in a big 5-litre car or something. Cycling everywhere is being done pretty quickly by that guy. But I do kind of hope that governments will eventually kind of gain the backbone to be able to give us sort of enforce a capping on some of the excesses that there are.
In 10 years, I will ask you again with part two, the same question. And then we will see where we are, where we stand in 10 years.
I'll be in like a caravan talking to you in virtual reality. Yeah, we'll have this in the metaverse. It'll be a...
Unfortunately, we arrived to the very last question of today's episode.
Okay.
And you already answered it, but I will ask it again.
Okay.
What means architecture for you personally?
I think architecture for me is a wonderful sort of journey that is a wonderful project that embodies it should embody the best of science, of art, of technology, all coming together at the same time to kind of sing in unison to create magical spaces that enhance people's lives, whether that's where they live, where they work, where they kind of go for leisure. Creating spaces that have an emotional being, create a reaction. I think that for me is what architecture is, opposed to simply the building of buildings. I'd say the vast majority of stuff that gets built when I'm being opinionated, I don't consider that architecture. It lacks the emotional provocation of real art.
Very poetic. Really nice. No, really nice. We can just leave it like this. Speechless. Thank you so much that you took the time. It was a pleasure talking to you. Really glad that you took the time.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much, Therese. It's been a real treat.
This was this week's episode. We really hope you liked it as much as we did. If you have comments, suggestions, critique, please let us know. And till next time on What's Next. Ciao, ciao.